Blog Talk Radio.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff.
Coach on Fire Radio.
I am the
Hello and welcome to the Flourish and Thrive radio show. This is episode 6 and I am Kate Hartley, your host, bringing you informative and inspiring guests to share their stories with you, to help you make the most of your life as well as helping you find your purpose. My guests bring a combination of inspirational stories, strategies for overcoming roadblocks, and proof that even when our lives take turns we could never imagine, or when we face challenges we could never predict, somehow, our metaphorical muscles keep us going. And in some cases, similar to my guest's story today, life takes on a whole different meaning. Challenges are faced and overcome. And out of the ashes of one of modern day's greatest tragedies, a place of education and inspiration is born. My guest today, Gary Marlon Suzon, was going about his daily business when the city of New York was brought to its knees during the terrible events at September the 11th, 2001. That single day has resulted in the loss of life of over 3,000 people, I believe. Gary, whose photographic studio was just a few blocks from the Twin Towers, started photographing the events of 9/11 shortly after the first tower was hit and continued for the next 9 months as the World Trade Center site was gradually cleared. Early on, he was declared the official photographer of Ground Zero and was allowed extensive and privileged access to the Ground Zero site. Thanks to his respectful documentation of the recovery efforts, he was welcomed into the Ground Zero Brotherhood, especially by firefighters. He photographed intimate scenes of the recovery process, the honor guard ceremonies in which fallen firefighters were carried out of Ground Zero by their fire department brothers on flag-draped stretchers, and he later founded the Ground Zero Museum Workshop. Requiem Ground Zero is a singular collection of 280 photographs which Gary captured as he worked alongside the workers, sharing in their heartbreaks and triumphs as they struggled to rescue, recover, and remember, successfully and sensitively capturing the very spirit of every worker on the World Trade Center site. His images have created a sensitive and visual history of this period where most adults can probably remember where they were and what they were doing when news of the attacks on the Twin Towers was first heard. Gary is the founder of the Ground Zero Museum Workshop, which is a child-friendly museum and won TripAdvisor's Top 25 Museums in the USA Award for 2013 and 14, and is rated 5 stars on TripAdvisor. He is also an honorary battalion chief in the Fire Department of New York. So just to remind you, if you want to call in and ask Gary any questions, call in on 646-716-7979. That number's also posted on social media. And if you're calling in from the UK, remember to dial 001 before the number. So call 001-646-716-7979. I feel as though I could go on and on, Gary, as there is so much to say about you, but I'm going to try and stop myself now and let you have some of the microphone time. So thank you for your patience and welcome to the Flourish and Thrive show. Thank you so much for being here with me today.
My pleasure. It's nice to be here.
Well, I really appreciate your time. And to start off our interview, can you give us a little bit of your backstory, please? You know, who or what was it that encouraged you into the world of photography?
Well, that's an easy answer. That was my mother, Sherry Suzon, and she noticed from age 11 that I had a very special eye for the camera. She used to collect everybody's film back when you know, we shot little rolls of film and Instamatic cameras, and she would develop all, I'm the youngest of five kids, and she would develop everyone's film, and then she was getting some of the images back and seeing these beautiful sunsets and beautiful flowers and just, you know, unorthodox photography for an 11-year-old, although I didn't realize that, of course. And she said, "Who shot this?" And I said, "I shot that." And she said, "You have a special eye, young man." And I said, "No, I don't." And she really believed. She thought that I had a special gift. So by age 14, my mother and father bought me a professional Canon camera, and then I began shooting more. And by age 17, I was very surprised and honored to win an award here in America called the Kodak Medallion.
Wow.
Which is the top honor for any high school student in America. And oddly enough, the winning photos were flown to New York and displayed at the World Trade Center, which I would later wind up documenting the fall of. So very ironic. So had my mother not pushed me so hard, and she did. She kept telling me how talented I was. I don't think any of this would exist.
So it's thanks to Sherry, your mom.
Yeah, I recently lost her to cancer, and so when I look at all these images, I think about how important it is for our parents, our mother, to support us in our arts and our endeavors, and how much it means to a small child to have the support of their parents.
Yeah, absolutely. It helps make a rounded adult, that's for sure, Gary.
Yep.
So can I ask you, how did you end becoming the official photographer of Ground Zero?
That's a weird story, but I'll keep it as short as possible. I was on the train riding out to Long Island, and I read in the Daily News that fire department doctors were confused with sick firefighters because their blood tests were coming back perfectly normal, but they were exhibiting symptoms of severe fatigue and asthma and mostly chronic fatigue, and they didn't have the answer. I felt I did have the answer because I became very sick from breathing in the fumes on 9/11, and I felt it was chemical toxic exposure. And so I made a call to Rudy Sanfilippo at the Uniformed Firefighters Association, the union that governs all the firefighters, and I said, mm-hmm. I said to him, I spoke to this environmental illness specialist out in Long Island, and he's willing to take a handful of you guys and see if he can't help you with the fatigue. And so Rudy said, yeah, that would be great. And so I became a liaison between the fire department's these sick firefighters and this specialist doctor who didn't charge them anything, and they were all getting intravenous vitamin drips and chelation, and they started getting better. And one day I was out there, and he says, "Hey, Rudy Sanfilippo says, hey, you're Gary Susan." I said, "Yeah," and he said, I appreciate what you've been doing for the guys." He says, "Someone told me that you shoot really nice photographs. Why don't you come into the fire union? I'd like to talk to you about it." And so, long story short, he had a need, and his need was that he needed to show that to the 9/11 families that their loved ones, their remains, the bodies that were being found were being treated with enormous respect. So I was put in there to document tastefully the honor guards, the flag-draped bodies, and basically portray the beauty of Ground Zero.
Mm-hmm.
He would later admit to me he didn't realize what a good job I would do. And, and he was so surprised at what I was shooting that, you know, he said, you know, keep shooting and shoot as much as you can. And I just went with it. So that's how it happened.
That's this amazing story. And you've mentioned that you've suffered from ill effects from Ground Zero too. What effects have you had as a result of working on the site? Because you were there for how many months was it, Gary?
Seven.
7 months. So what effects has it caused on your health?
Well, I mean, there's a few. First off, asthma, COPD, post-traumatic stress disorder, chronic fatigue, and very severe chemical allergies. I'm very allergic to VOCs, volatile organic compounds. So because of my exposure to all those chemicals for 7 months at the Trade Center, my body became very toxic and sensitive to chemicals. So that includes dental fillings, dental materials, anesthesias. I have to be very careful with anything that's, you know, put in my immune system, because I can and I have had very severe allergic reactions. I'll give you a good example. About 2 months ago, they were putting new carpeting and new paint in my hallway where I live. New carpeting is covered in formaldehyde chemical, and they were using very strong glues and resins to bond the carpeting to the floor, and they were using paint. And I was having such severe asthma. My neck was swelling up. My face was 3 times swollen, the tissue. One night I slept in the bathtub and put towels underneath the door to stop the fumes from coming in, and slept with an air cleaner in my bathroom. And you can tell me that's normal? That's not normal. So,
no,
it's
not normal.
No, so I wound up sleeping elsewhere after that and finding somewhere else to sleep for the month. But it's just it's hard for anyone to really understand the chemicals that we breathe in at ground zero. There's such – there was a carcinogenic cocktail of every type of chemical that you could ever imagine. And over the course of many months, that weakened our immune system, and now – that is manifesting itself as cancer for many, many 9/11 rescue and first responders. And here's an interesting fact for you: more people have now died from 9/11 related cancers and illnesses than actually died on the morning of 9/11.
Oh my goodness!
Yes,
that's absolutely shocking. So, can you? I mean, I suppose when the towers originally collapsed, there was a huge amount of mayhem and panic and almost hysteria, I suppose, just trying to recover survivors if at all possible. And were you given any protective apparatus to go into the site, or did everybody just literally do what they could and hopefully not have too serious consequences afterwards?
Well, on the morning of 9/11, it was a free-for-all. I mean, if you could get a mask, great. And if you didn't, you couldn't stop working. And nobody was cognizant of the fact that there was powdered asbestos and glass. And, you know, nobody was aware of that. Now, later, OSHA came in, Occupational Safety and Hazard came in, and it was required that you had to wear a mask. But a lot of these old-time firefighters, they just didn't want to be bothered with a big mask on their face. They, you know, they're digging for many hours, and they didn't want to be bothered. And add to that we were told a lie. And one of the lies that was told to us is that the air was safe. Now, what they didn't tell us was that the little meter that reads the air quality was 1 mile away from ground zero. So they're telling us that the air, so they're telling us that the air quality is safe, and it wasn't safe. And so for months, we're breathing in. You know, most of us wore masks, so you couldn't wear it all the time. I mean, I had this big, giant, like Ansel Adams camera. How am I gonna put the eye cup up to my face with a big mask? I can't. But I did my best to try and wear it. I think I wore mine more than most people. I took it seriously. So, because I was having asthma while I was down there. So I had to wear the mask more than as much as I possibly could.
And has anything been done to help remedy your problems beyond your, you know, you reaching out to the environmental illness specialist people?
Well, there's the Mount Sinai World Trade Center Health Program, and that's funded by the James Zadroga Act in Congress in Washington. And that provides a specific amount of health care for sick 9/11 workers. But in my opinion, it doesn't offer a cure. It only offers treatment. So they'll give you free asthma pumps. They'll give you medicine. They screen you for different types of illness. They do x-rays, and that's all funded by Congress. The problem is Washington does not believe in environmental medicine or holistic health care. And for World Trade Center sick workers to get better, they need that type of care, but Congress won't pay for it. They pay for conventional, standard, conservative medicine. So, unfortunately, you know, I have to pay out of pocket, out of my own money, if I want to get the type of health care I need in order to, you know, try to live somewhat of a normal life. So once every Monday, I take the train 2 hours to an environmental illness specialist, and I get intravenous vitamin C drips in my arm, and intravenous vitamin C, glutathione, and magnesium. And these vitamins going right into the blood, they boost the immune system, and they bring some of my symptoms down.
I've seen a photo of you on Facebook on with your IV. Is that the vitamin C IV that you have then?
Say that again?
I've seen photographs of you on Facebook with the intravenous thing
going in.
Is that your vitamin C intravenous?
Yeah, that's 30,000 milligrams of vitamin C, and that goes right into the blood. The problem is most of us who worked at Ground Zero, we have stomach problems, so you swallow vitamins and they don't get assimilated into the blood. But when you get an intravenous vitamin C drip, it goes right into the blood, and it can bring your histamine levels down. It can make your asthma decrease. But unfortunately, Washington's not going to pay for that.
Why is that? That just seems crazy that you guys have all given your lives virtually to this event, and they're not helping you afterwards.
You're dealing with old Washington conservatives, you know, filet mignon, brandy, and candied potatoes. They don't really care. You know, they're not interested in listening to alternative medicine.
Well, we fight the same battle over here, because at the end of the day, money is worth more than health in a lot of cases. And we find our drug companies here, if it's got a good price on it, they'll go for it. And if it hasn't, well, then tough.
Exactly. So,
No, I also read a figure, and I'm not sure if this figure's absolutely right, or I heard the figure, that over 35% of deaths of the rescue workers and the firefighters since 9/11 have been attributable to suicide. Is that right?
That's correct. And I know one that did commit suicide, Mike LaRosa. He's a firefighter and great guy. And nobody knew what he was going through. And one day he was dead. But yeah, there's a lot of suicides. I wish I could say why. I mean, I can only tell you my own personal thing is that we witnessed a lot of horrific, horrific things down there. And if things, you know, it's not like a typical war zone. Like, I don't know what a typical British or American soldier goes through in Iraq or Afghanistan. They don't know what I went through in Ground Zero. We each have our own horror stories. One thing I will tell you is that in typical war zones, people, if they die, it's usually a whole body or most of it. Ground Zero wasn't like that. It was bad. It was, you know, almost everyone was unidentifiable. We only found 292 whole bodies out of 3,000 people.
My goodness, gosh. So have you received counseling for your PTSD since?
I had a couple years of a specialized PTSD therapy designed for World Trade Center workers, and that was funded by Congress. That was at Columbia University. They had a psychology department there. And it was a very, very exhaustive program that they basically, I had to relive every horrible moment that I witnessed at Ground Zero, and I had to relive it over and over and over again. They would make you talk about it, and then you move on to the next horrific moment. And it was designed to desensitize us to the images that are in our head.
Has that helped?
I think it helped a lot. It's the only reason I can come to the museum and talk to people and be social and not break down crying is that because I have had so much therapy to try and assimilate back into normal life.
And I wanted to ask you about the museum because for me it just seems such an inspirational thing to develop as a result of your involvement with Ground Zero. So what was it that drove you to create or even have the idea of creating the Ground Zero Museum workshop?
It was two incidents that happened that inspired me. Sorry, three incidents that inspired me to build the museum workshop. The first one was I went to Europe to clear my head. It was 2004. I went to the Anne Frank House, and I was blown away by how her room is just her room, but it's very powerful, very simplistic, minimalistic, but that's the room she slept in. You can still see her photos on the wall, and it blew me away how such a tiny, tiny space could be so impactful and left me in tears. And then I jumped on a plane to visit my friends in England, and they took me to a graveyard that had mass burial graves of all the little school children who died during the World War II Blitz.
Uh-huh.
And I stood out, I stood in front of that grave, and I was so choked up. And it said, you know, Timmy Blakefield, age 2. Mary Johnson, age 4. And it was like 50 children all under the age of 5. Because then, you know, the Hitler bombed nursery schools. He didn't care, you know. And I couldn't believe what I was standing in front of. And it just these two experiences, I came back to New York and I thought, you know, there needs to be a museum. And the museum at Ground Zero wasn't going anywhere. It was still basically a hole in Manhattan. It was concrete hole. And no one was doing anything. There was arguments going on between the city and the developers of the site. And so I started calling the MoMA, the Guggenheim, every major museum in New York. And I said, hi, this is Gary Marlin Susan, yada, yada, yada. I was the official photographer of Ground Zero. I think we should collaborate to put up a beautiful exhibit. I have images and I have access to artifacts. And I think we should collaborate to put together a special museum. And they all said the same thing. We're not interested. The public wants to move on from Ground Zero, but thank you so much for calling.
My goodness.
That is exactly what happened, and that's when I decided to convert. I had a 1,000-square-foot photo studio loft in a meatpacking district in Manhattan, and I thought, well, this is going to be the craziest thing I've ever done, but I'm going to build the biggest little museum in New York. And so I converted the loft into what is now the Ground Zero Museum Workshop, and I had a lot of help from a lot of people, and we decided to try to create something really meaningful that would, that would make a difference in people's lives, help people understand what it was like to work at Ground Zero, you know?
Oh, do you know what? I really hope that your museum rates higher on TripAdvisor than the other big ones.
I'll tell you what's really funny, and I have to laugh at this, and you probably will too. But in 2004, all those museums told me, no, we're not interested. The public wants to move on. And in the summer of 2009, our museum hit number one on TripAdvisor in New York City, and we beat out all those museums.
Yay.
And our museum, yeah, isn't that crazy? And our museum is 1,000 square feet. Literally, it's the size of the bathroom at the MoMA. So, or at the Guggenheim.
That's so good.
I think the Guggenheim's bathroom is bigger than our museum. but we topped them all, and people started taking notice of us then. And right now, much to my surprise, and I don't say this in a braggadocious way, I say this very humbly, if you were to log on to TripAdvisor right now and look under top 10 New York City museums, we're number four in all of New York. And that's really an honor for us because we have worked really hard to handcraft the most memorable tour with 100 stories programmed into handsets with Bose headphones. People can hear all these stories in Dolby Stereo with real sound effects from Ground Zero programmed in the background behind all these images and artifacts that we have on display. So it's not an accident that we got rated 5 stars and we made it up the list. We worked really hard to give the public a really special museum experience.
I've seen a few of your Facebook sort of, I don't know what they call them, those 360 image rotation things and of the museum. And it just looks brilliant. And the thing that I love about it the most is that it's child-friendly. There are so many children there learning
about... Well, that's
about...
a big deal. That's
God,
a big deal for
could you explain
us.
A bit more about that?
Yeah. Well, the thing is our museum does not focus on the harrowing day of 9/11. We stay 99% away from that. If people want to see what happened on that day, there's YouTube. Or they can go down to the 9/11 Memorial Museum at Ground Zero, and they give a very detailed picture of what happened that day. We stay away from that because we originally designed ourselves to be to host 9/11 families. We wanted to show the families what... the beautiful stories, the uplifting patriotic stories, the amazing people that came out of Ground Zero. So along the way, I didn't realize it when I was doing that, when I was building it, but we became known as the kid-friendly 9/11 museum, the museum that parents can feel safe gently teaching their kids about 9/11 without showing them horrible images of people jumping to their deaths or planes slamming into towers or towers collapsing. You know, you got to be careful about showing children, young children, these types of imagery. You just have to, there has to be a gentle segue where you can teach them. And that's how we became known as the kid-friendly 9/11 museum, because we stay away from all that. The other thing is we live in a very this is the iPhone generation. The iPhone only came out in 2005, and this is the iPhone generation. And so we get kids as young as age 5, but they take to our audio tour because they love punching the buttons, they love the headphones, and they're independent of their parents, and they run off on their own, and they go listen to all these stories. I'm at the museum right now, and about 45 minutes ago, we had two parents and their 10-year-old daughter named Amaya, and they are visiting from Scotland. And she was listening to the stories, and they were done, and she said to me, "We've been all over Manhattan. We can't hold Amaya's attention." And I can't get over how engrossed she is in this tour, Gary. I mean, look at her. She's over there in a corner. She's listening to stories, and we can't get over how this little museum has held her attention. So it was kind of an accident the way it happened, but nevertheless, that's the long-winded answer.
It just seems to be so successful. Whatever you found seems to be working. And I saw something earlier about your crosses that you make now and your St. David's cross as well, that you having those fabricated and sell them as merchandise?
Well, we're not having them fabricated, but we have on display steel crosses and Jewish Stars of David burned from actual... World Trade Center steel. By the way, happy Passover to all your Jewish listeners. That's an appropriate time to say that.
Absolutely. Happy Passover.
Yeah, happy Passover. And so we have a rare Star of David that was burned from an actual beam, and we have crosses that were burned from beams, and we show these to the guests because these are actual pieces that we used to give to little children that lost a mom or a dad in the tragedy.
Gosh, that's very poignant. There's a photo in your book of the Star of David, and it's just such a poignant image. It's an amazing book. When did you actually create that, Gary?
That was actually made by Barnes & Noble Publishing. They produced my book in 2002, and it was actually printed in your neck of the woods. It was printed in Somerset, England.
Cider country.
Yeah, by a famous book, a famous book printing company called Butler and Tanner, who unfortunately went out of business. They were the oldest book printers in New York, in England. They're from the 1800s. And by the way, as an aside, when I was over there, I went to go visit the Bath Museum. And when I went to see the Bath Museum, I learned about the self-guided audio wands, and that's how I came to put those in our museum.
I think that's a really good idea, and also the fact that the visitors, but particularly the children, can actually touch artifacts from 9/11. It's just
makes
it much more real to them.
Oh yeah, that's what sets us apart from other museums. We're the only 9/11 museum in New York that allows our visitors to pick up and hold World Trade Center artifacts. We think it hits home for people more when they can pick up a tangible piece of the World Trade Center.
Absolutely. And that clock that you've got, I only saw that today. It was just like, it was breathtaking. It stopped right at the time as the electricity was uttered. Is that right, when the first plane hit?
Yeah, it's called the Frozen Clock, and it's a big Timex clock that I found underneath Ground Zero in the abandoned subway tunnels. It was in a small room, and when the electricity blew to the World Trade Center site, when the tower collapsed, it took out the electricity underneath the everywhere. I mean, everything was severed, and so the clock was frozen at 10:02 and 14 seconds, which was the exact time that the first tower collapsed. So with permission, I was able to save that clock because I shot a photo of it. So I asked the battalion chief, I shot this photo of the clock, can I please save it for historical purposes? And he said yes, and it sat in storage for many years. I didn't know what I was going to do with it. And then eventually, when I came up with the idea of the museum, it became one of the centerpiece artifacts in the Ground Zero Museum workshop.
Yeah, it's very, very powerful. And tell me, for people who want to come and visit your museum, how do they do that, Gary? Do they buy tickets online, or what's the deal with it?
Yeah, they buy tickets at groundzeromuseumworkshop.org, or they can if they go to TripAdvisor, and there's a direct link right off of TripAdvisor, they can buy tickets off of Viator. I think Viator is pretty popular in England, in the UK. Or they can call us at 212-924-1040. But groundzeromuseumworkshop.org is the best way to buy tickets.
Okay, well, we'll make sure we put all of that in the promotional blurb that goes out after this
also
show.
Also, there's the Explorer Pass. The Explorer Pass is a very popular, people pre-purchase a pass with like 5 or 10 attractions preloaded, and we're one of the selections they can choose.
I should think most people now come to New York to visit your museum rather than going to New York and then happening upon your museum. I have to say, I'm going to come to New York especially to come and visit your museum, and the rest that I see is just peripheral.
Well, I'm very honored. We would love to have you. And also, oddly enough, if you were to go to the One World Trade Center Observatory, that's the new tower, the World Trade Center, they have an observatory on the 100 and the 101st and 2nd floors. I'm very proud and honored to say that my images are of the new tower, images of the new tower, not of 9/11. My images are for sale currently on T-shirts, puzzles, keychains, and very beautiful, not commercial photos, but very beautiful, poignant images I shot of the tower. And so it gives me a big sense of pride to know that people are taking home merchandise with my images on them, because it makes my life come full circle, because I documented the tragedy and now I can be part of the rebirth, you know?
Well, do you know what? I think a lot of people don't even know that the World Trade Center Observatory actually stands on the Ground Zero site.
It does.
Because they're such beautiful images that you've created for those.
Will
that develop into another book again, or?
Who knows? I have no idea. if the observatory ever asked me to do a book, I would not hesitate to say yes, but that remains to be seen. I've collected quite a beautiful collection of images, but You know, for now, I'm just happy to have some of my images on merchandise up there.
And can you also get those in the museum?
No, we don't sell the World Trade Observatory items in the museum. They can only be purchased up at the tower.
And can you buy those online, or do you literally have to be in the World Trade Center Observatory to buy those?
You know, I actually went on their website, and I did not see my merchandise on there. Perhaps when they update it in the future, it will be available. But I think, I don't think it's available. I think you actually have to be there.
Okay.
I think you actually have to be there. If any of your guests want to email me, have any questions about that, they can just it's very simple. They can just email me at the museum. It's ground0ticket, T-I-C-K-E-T, at AOL.com, ground0ticket at AOL.com, and I can try to help them in some way.
Okay, I'll make a note of that for the after show notes as well, and I'll contact you after this, Gary, and we'll just go through a few things to make sure I've got all the details right, but we'll put all that blur back. Right, now Gary, you have asked to have Ludovico Einaudi played as your song, and the track that you've chosen is Fly. Is it okay to play that now?
Sure.
I just love this piece of music, so sit back and enjoy it for 5 minutes, and then we'll resume in another 5 minutes or so.
Sure.
And so Gary uses that Ludovico NOD piece as his backing track on his 5-minute YouTube video showcasing some of his images from Ground Zero, which I really recommend you go and search out. I think if you go onto YouTube and do a search for Gary Marlon Susan, you should find that. That's how I came across it. But I will also put links in the show notes after this.
Yeah. Even if you just type in Einaudi, however you say his name, just type in his last name and my last name on YouTube, S-U-S-O-N, okay, and his last name, it'll pop up.
Yep, NOD is E-I-N-A-U-D-I, and just a little bit of blurb about him. He was an Italian pianist and composer born in 1955. We love him at home. My daughter plays him all the time on her piano. But I watched an article about him, and he, like you, Gary, he loves to use light and different perspectives with his art form. And he was talking about how he tries to add different perspectives of light, emotion and tempo with the melodic quality of repetition and the darkness in that piece, which is all pervading. So basically,
it's almost haunting.
It is. It is haunting, and it really shapes the music.
I think the photos from
9/11. I find it really peaceful.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, sorry. No, I just said I find it really peaceful. What were you going to say about it?
No, just that his haunting music, it's beautiful but haunting, and it mixes with the 9/11 images very nice.
It does. They both complemented each other beautifully. Gary, I wanted to ask you as well. I understand you've been the victim of fake news. And
I was, yeah.
Can you talk about that and how it affected you at all?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, I'm not going to get into the details of what they wrote, but I'm sure you have you have tabloid newspapers in England, yeah?
Yeah, we've managed to get rid of a few, actually, over the years.
Well, there's one well-known here in New York called the New York Post. Rupert Murdoch owns it. And
oh,
in 2005, I was victimized by horrible fake news stories, which caused me enormous emotional pain and humiliation. It was regarding 9/11 and Ground Zero and my museum. And I got caught in the middle of, I was basically used as a patsy between two fire union members who didn't like each other. Rudy Sanfilippo, who put me in Ground Zero, he is a member of the fire union, as I told you earlier in the interview. Rudy had a very big falling out with his president, Steve Cassidy, the fire union. And basically when my museum opened, Steve Cassidy thought it would be a really good opportunity to get back at Rudy Sanfilippo, because every time I was in the news, Rudy was in the news. And when the museum first opened, a worldwide story came out about the Anne Frank connection to my museum. It went worldwide. The president of the fire union saw this, and they saw, man, it's a great opportunity to get back at Rudy Sanfilippo. Let's use Gary Susan to do that, because they knew it would upset him very much. And so the Post put out these stories that they were not investigated. There was no background, nothing. It was just factless misinformation put together to try and hurt our little museum and hurt me. And it did hurt me. It hurt me very much. And luckily, some very powerful 9/11 families stuck up for the museum.
Good.
Yeah, very powerful 9/11 families fought back for us. And but it has caused damage. And, you know, it's shown its ugly head here and there over the last 12 years. You know, when you do interviews with big corporation, or big corporations want to work with you, there's a vetting process.
Mm-hmm.
So those fake stories pop up, and, you know, you have to have an answer for that. And luckily, you know, I have very powerful court documents signed by our current fire commissioner, as well as the president of the 9/11 Families Association, saying that those stories are 100% fake. And it's because of those documents that I luckily have been able to sidestep those ugly stories and have some success.
Well, there's always going to be some rats that crawl out of the woodwork.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you know, I'm glad you touched upon that, because fake news is an epidemic, and it's, you know, it's becoming it's been around for years, but I don't think they had a title for it. But fake news ruins lives. It smears people. It's character assassination. And I'm very, very lucky. I'm a very lucky guy that I was able to sidestep it. And, you know, truth, having truth on your side is always a very good thing.
Yeah, but I agree with you. Fake news does ruin lives. And I just think there should be more control over it. They should be accountable for what they say. You know, what happened to libel?
Well, you're actually
taking responsibility for your words.
Actually, you know, Melania Trump just settled a lawsuit with the Daily Mail in England. Now, England, you can sue them and you can win. But here in America, we have a little thing called freedom of speech and the First Amendment. And these newspapers, they put out fake news stories, and then they hide behind the First Amendment. They hide behind it because it says, you know, basically, in order to prove, in order to prove a fake news story, you have to prove actual malice, meaning just proving that the person wrote it is not enough to win your case. You have to prove somehow, which is impossible, that when the person wrote it, they knew that it was a lie. And that's impossible because you can't subpoena someone's brain. You know?
No.
But in England, it's much easier to sue for these fake news stories and actually win, as Melania Trump just demonstrated.
Yeah, well, we've actually brought a couple of very large Rupert Murdoch papers down in the last decade, and, you know, long may it continue as well. And the tabloid press as well, there are much stricter controls over those. I think possibly actually since Princess Diana was, since she had her car accident, but, you know, if she wasn't being chased by the paparazzi, she wouldn't have had that crash. So I do
exactly.
hold them responsible for that.
Exactly, they are responsible. And that was a tragic, tragic day. I was am a big fan of Lady Diana, and I'm very honored to say I got to see her live and in person right in front of me about a year before she died. I was very young, but I got to see her.
Yes, her death affected an awful lot of people across the world. She was a very, very special woman. Gary, just because we're sort of into the last sort of 12 minutes of our interview now, I can't believe how fast this has gone. I need another hour at least. Can I ask you, are you working with the 9/11 memorial at Ground Zero?
I am not. Currently, I am not.
Okay.
I hope to work with them in the future. It's a beautiful museum. It's a gigantic museum compared to our humble little museum. In 2013, unfortunately, we were unable to have a meeting of the minds. Oftentimes that can happen between artists and museums, or museums and museums. I support that museum very much. I support their message and their mission. And I actually know, some of the people that work there. And unfortunately, in 2013, we could not see eye to eye on a few things, and so we went our separate ways. But I'm very, very happy that this year, 2017, 4 years later, I have had some very productive and healthy talks with one of the powers that be there, and I was very happy to reconnect with her.
Good.
And They've shown some interest in working together in the future, and that's something that I would like, because at the end of the day, it's not really about me, and it's not about my museum, and it's not about the 9/11 memorial. It's about the people that come to New York that could learn from my photos. And now they can come to my museum and they can learn from my photos, but obviously it would be nice to have it also in the memorial for the people that don't make it to my museum. And so, in the end run, for historical purposes, you know, I would love to collaborate with the 9/11 memorial.
I think, it makes total sense, because right now it's all about educating the future generations and hopefully avoiding another situation such as what was 9/11 at the time.
Exactly.
What does, I mean, on the whole, when you see people in the museum, you must get a really good feeling of, I suppose not just, I was going to just ask about New Yorkers, because obviously it happened there, but on the whole, what kind of sentiments do you get about Ground Zero and your education of people with your museum and also their memories of the events of 9/11?
Every story is different. We had a woman in our museum about 2 hours ago. I came in early today to prepare for this interview, and she was telling me she was a school teacher. As a matter of fact, this story just got told to me 2 hours ago, and I'll tell it for your listeners. It'll probably choke you up, though. But she was a school teacher. She was in Manhattan, and all the children were at the window because the first tower was smoking, and they were watching it. And nobody really knew what was happening, so they were letting the kids have their faces pressed against the window, looking at the tower smoke when the second plane slammed into the second tower, and it was a huge explosion, and the kids started crying, and one of the children said to her, my mommy is in that building.
Oh, my goodness.
Is my mommy going to be okay? And she didn't know what to say. And that child was an only child. The father had died. And that child's mom did die in that tower.
Oh.
So she just shared that story with me. It was very, really a tearjerker, choked me up. The general response from our guests is wonderful. I would be very hurt if they didn't derive something out of our museum. You know, we're about helping people heal through these incredible stories. So I'm hoping that continues. But you know, we just we take each day as it comes.
I think what you're doing is an incredible thing, and I love the fact that you're educating the children so well with it as well. Gary, as we're sort of running into our last 7 minutes of the show, are there any sort of last-minute thoughts or inspirations you would like to leave us with?
Oh, gosh, I wouldn't know where to begin.
Take your top two or three.
Let's talk about my favorite cheeseburger now. Well, I will say that we get an enormous amount of visitors from the U.K., and I'm not just saying this to be nice. I'm telling the truth. The UK visitors are so sensitive and appreciative to this tragedy, and we appreciate that. I'll share another interesting thing with you. There is a place in England called the Malvern Hills. It's also known as British Camp, and it's an old fortress built on a giant hill, and it overlooks Wales. Buried up on in those hills, unbeknownst to people from England, is are pieces of World Trade Center steel and World Trade Center window glass that I personally buried up there as a tribute to the British citizens that died in the World Trade Center.
Oh, my goodness, I didn't know that. Is there like statue or a plaque or something?
No, I made it hidden so no one would ever dig it up.
That's incredible. We need a picture of that in your next book, please.
but
we know where to go.
If anyone ever takes a hike up to the very top of the hills, they can know that underneath that dirt, and I buried it very deep, underneath that dirt is a piece of the World Trade Center steel and glass.
What inspired you to do that, Gary?
You know, I'm just try to be an ambassador of goodwill. I realize that I represent this tragedy on a small level. Obviously, you know, it's a small role I have, but nevertheless, I'm a goodwill ambassador, and I accept that role, although it's a little awkward for me. But I just try to do good things in the name of the tragedy, things that are sensitive, you know, to those who died. And so I happen to be aware that many British people did die in the World Trade Center. So I thought, well, we should have a piece of a chunk of glass from the windows and a chunk of steel. And it should be up at the top of British Camp, Malvern Hills, overlooking, you know, portion of England, you know.
What made you choose the Malvern Hills out of interest?
Well, I got invited out to the Worcester Fire Department.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Hereford, or Hereford and Worcester.
Yeah.
And I think I pronounced that correctly.
And Hereford
and
Worcester, you did.
Yes. Perhaps I'll finish out my interview doing my proper British dialect.
Well, don't expect me to do American. I'm terrible at accents.
No. I will let you go on that. No, but I was visiting the fire departments there, and I had these rare artifacts, and I thought, you know, I said to the chief at the fire department, and I said, we should do something nice with this. We should bury this somewhere. And he thought, well, why don't we bury it up at the top, the highest point we can do? And so that's what we did. I will end on one thing, is that our museum has needs more support and more funding, and we have a beautiful online museum store now that just opened. It's groundzeromuseumstore.org, and people can purchase all the merchandise from our store here in New York, and we FedEx to England now. So if people do want to support us and our mission and help us stay open, they can just go to groundzeromuseumstore.org and they can make an online purchase of my book or T-shirts or whatever they want.
Fantastic. And is your artwork for sale there as well, your photography?
It's only photography of the World Trade Center that we sell at the store.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but some of those images are amazing. I mean, I've got my daughter bought me the book very kindly, and I absolutely love it.
Sure.
Thank you. It's quite addictive to read, but to have some of the individual prints would be really special as well.
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, it's very classy merchandise. We don't sell the hawkish, mawky, tacky merchandise. We sell really classy items of remembrance, and you know, we just try to keep things as classy as possible.
Well, that's classy is a very good note to end on. Well, thank you. Crikey, it's just so. I wish I'd got longer to talk to you. I feel like I have to keep stopping now because
we've got
it comes to the end of our time.
You can ask one more question in 2 minutes.
Which one shall I ask? I've still got so many I'd like to ask you.
I can give you a quick answer.
Okay, let me think. Okay, what do you think about the World Trade Center Observatory? Does it get the thumbs up or the thumbs down?
Absolute thumbs up. It's so beautiful. It
is
so classy. It's so clean and sleek. The observatory, you can see in every direction around Manhattan. It blows the top of the rock out of the water, and it blows away the Empire State Building. It's the most unbelievable views of Manhattan, New Jersey, Brooklyn. You can see the Brooklyn Bridge. I mean, you got to bring a camera up there because it's so amazing. And lastly, the elevator ride going up is only 60 seconds or so, and as you go up, the walls of the elevator are a movie theater, and they start from New York City in the 1800s, and as the elevator goes up, you see the city building with the towers going up, so you get to watch in 60 seconds the 1800s or 1700s all the way through to 2017. It'll blow your mind.
Oh, my goodness. Right, I'm coming to New York. I'm coming to see you and the World Observatory, definitely. It's the tallest building, isn't it, in the Western Hemisphere now?
Yes, it is. It is. It is.
Right, I'm coming soon, Gary. I shall let you know. So, anyway, all links to Gary will be posted on my Flourish Therapy Facebook page, which you can find at facebook.com/theflourishtherapy.co.uk. And I will include all links to Gary and the store and everything else that we've mentioned today in the interview. The book, The Requiem Images of Ground Zero, is available at Barnes & Noble Books, and I really recommend you go and buy it. It's just an absolutely beautiful compilation.
You can't get it at Barnes & Noble Books. You can only get it through our museum now. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, groundzeromuseumstore.org, you can order the book.
Okay, so I'll include that as well. Your contribution to the memory of 9/11 is a thread which will bind us all together in some way, shape or form for the rest of our lives, Gary. In the creation of Requiem Ground Zero and the Ground Zero Museum Workshop, you've left us with a legacy to help educate future generations about what happened after the 9/11 attacks. I thank you so much for being my guest on the Flourish and Thrive radio show today. And to our listeners, thank you all so much for being here. Gary Marlin Suzanne was my compelling and just fascinating guest. And you can find more about Gary at www.groundzeromuseumworkshop.org. Thank you all so much for listening, and make the most of what you have now. Go out there and live your best lives as though today was your last day. And until the next time, I'm saying goodbye from both of us. And again, a huge thank you to you, Gary.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
I can do anything. I can reach any goal today. I can do what I want. I can be what I want to be.
Coach on Fire Radio.